What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, "Did you ever know that you're my hero?" I'm Jonathan Strickland. Come on, I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
I'm Joe McCormick. That's the best one yet.
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, it's thematic, right? We're talking about wind power today.
The future.
Yeah, the future of wind power.
It's big fans.
Yes, big fans.
Increasingly large ones.
Right.
Fans the size of planets.
Yes, we're a little loopy today. We're talking about wind power today. And before we talk about the future of it, obviously we should probably set up, you know, the fact that what's the past of wind power? What is wind power? How do we harness wind power? And how long have we been doing that?
Well, I think the important fact here to think about is how is wind created? And that is basically when the sun heats an area of land and the air above that land absorbs some of the heat, making it warmer and therefore less dense than air that might be hanging out above it. At a certain point, it'll suddenly rise and that cool air above it will rush down to fill the space. That is how wind is essentially created.
Right. And wind exerts a force. It pushes. So anything that pushes has the capacity to do some sort of work if we can only figure out a way of channeling it and harnessing it.
The ancients did, actually. They had wind turbines, too. They were called windmills.
Yeah, windmills are very, very similar to turbines. In this case, you're not talking about generating electricity. You're talking about turning some sort of mill that could crush stuff.
Right, you're just moving kinetic force from one place to another.
Right, you're translating it a little bit.
But say, yeah, you build a big tower and you make some big blades that the wind will turn when it blows, and that turns a crank that, say, crushes grain into flour.
Right.
Or maybe like moves a water wheel or a water pump
to pull water up from a river
or lake.
Yep, yep. And also, I mean, we've been harnessing wind in other ways. Obviously, sailing would be a big win. You know, using sails.
We've had sailboats since about 3000 BCE, and those fancy windmills. Yeah, you're getting up there. Yeah,
you know.
And we've had those fancy windmills since about People aren't really sure. It's something between 200 and 2000 BCE. I know that's a large time span.
Things like that don't tend to last throughout the millennia, but we've been using the wind to do work for us for quite some time. Now, as far as using wind in the sense of creating electricity, that's far more recent. In fact, it was really around the 1980s when that technology had reached a level of sophistication where we could, you know, put it to practical use.
Right. In rural areas, as early as like the 1920s or 30s, windmills were supplying a little bit of electricity where basically the power lines weren't going.
But for anything for like a significant amount of electricity, you really have to look at the fairly recent past. And even then, it was a little shaky. A lot of the wind turbines that went up in the 80s were made out of material that wasn't necessarily ideal, didn't last very long. There were a lot of maintenance issues. Wind power turbines broke down fairly frequently in a lot of those early wind farms.
And they were covered in all those neon signs.
They were really only producing about 150 kilowatts, like ideally, of energy, which is nothing really compared to today.
Right, right. And so, you know, there's some interesting abandoned wind farms in various parts of the United States, including Hawaii. I've seen some pictures of a wind farm in Hawaii where the turbines haven't been producing electricity for years, but they're still standing there. No one's actually taken them down.
Hanging out like big pinwheels.
And in fact, there are some wind turbines out there that are not producing electricity. They turn because the companies want them to continue to turn to force oil through the various workings of the system, but they're not actually generating electricity. However, to an outside observer who doesn't know that that's what's going on, it may look like they're fully functional. However, let's talk about what they're actually doing, how they're converting kinetic energy into electric energy. And it's a pretty simple design, really. So you've got these long rotor blades that are designed to, you know, catch the wind. So the wind will push these blades and turn them. They're on a hub that rotates. The hub is actually attached to a main shaft, and the main shaft will also turn. You know, it rotates as well due to the rotational force that we get from these blades. And it usually runs through some sort of gearbox where the gears will translate that into a faster rotational force. Cause, you know, if you use different size gears, you can change the speed, the revolutions per minute, really. That will then go through a generator, and a generator essentially uses magnets to rotate past a conductor. And that, you know, once you have a conductor in the presence of a fluctuating magnetic field, you induce current to flow. Right? So if you are able, Joe's just looking at me like, you're talking magic talk.
I'm sorry. It was like magnets, but how do they work?
That's an excellent question. We'll cover that in a different episode. So anyway, the rotational motion of the magnets creates this fluctuating magnetic field, which you then, with the conductor, can use to generate electricity. So that's the basic design. That's pretty much been the same way since we started building wind turbines. And it's very similar to the way other turbines work. Not just wind turbines, steam turbines are very similar. You know, obviously it's using steam, not wind, but mm-hmm. same sort of general idea. Now, you guys have, I guess, seen wind turbines. I don't know if you've ever seen them in person. Have you ever seen one in person? Like an actual, like, wind farm?
I don't think I have. I think I might have flown over them at one point. But
I think I've seen them in California.
I've seen them in Salt Lake City. There was an area I went to in Salt Lake City where there was a wind farm right outside of Salt Lake. And there were quite a few there, actually. It was kind of interesting. We kept driving by it and realizing, oh, good, now we're 30 minutes away from the hotel.
I tell you what I've seen a lot of, though, is stock images of them. Because for some reason, we are just rich with stock images.
That is true. Well, yes. If you've seen them in person or even just an image, as long as you get a sense of scale, you notice that they're pretty tall, right? They can be a couple hundred feet tall, 300 feet tall sometimes. I mean, these are big structures. And the reason for that is that the winds tend to be more stable and steady at higher altitudes. At ground level, you may not be able to get a steady wind for any length of time. And it may not be, you know, strong enough to turn the turbines. They really need to turn at a speed of about, you need to get a wind of around 12 to 14 miles per hour minimum, which is about 19 to 22 kilometers per hour in force for it to really turn these blades properly. And you get a much better, steady supply of wind at a higher altitude, which is why these things are so tall. And they do tend to generate between around 50 to 300 kilowatts of energy, depending upon the design of the turbine. No two turbines are, you know, they aren't created equally, depending upon who made them and how they were designed. And their efficiency ranges quite a bit, too. And that depends heavily on where you put them and just the design of the wind turbine as well. And by efficiency, I mean how often are they actually generating electricity? So a lot of the capacity for a wind turbine is determined by if the turbine were turning at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, constantly. If there was a constant supply of wind, here's how much electricity that turbine would generate, and then you have the number. But in reality, that tends to be a much smaller percentage than the overall.
In most places, the wind is not going 24 hours a day.
Right.
Yeah, I would imagine that gets more business during the daytime, right?
Well, it all depends. All depends on where it is, really. But we'll talk a bit about the pros and cons of wind energy when we get toward the end of this episode, and I'll give a few more details on percentages as for how efficient these things can be, and it really heavily depends upon where you put them. But we've got that basic design down. People have recognized that it's got an interesting approach to harvesting the wind and getting electricity out of it. That's something that appeals to a lot of people because it means being able to shift some of our dependency on, say, greenhouse gas emitting forms of generating electricity. But there's still some problems with it. So there have been a lot of people looking into ways of innovating in the space, and I wanted to talk about some of those. So have you guys heard of the Solar Wind Energy Tower? Joe, you have heard about this, right? You're just kind of grinning at me. You want to hear
is
what it looks like?
Is this the one in China?
No.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's not one in China. This is one that actually they're talking about building one in like the Mojave Desert. But, all right. So imagine a tower. It looks, kind of like a cooling tower that you would see at a nuclear power plant. But all right. So this tower is hollow. It's like a hollow cylinder. And at the base of the tower is a ring of turbines that faces so that the blades are facing so that they're facing into the tower. So wind coming from the middle of the tower going out would turn the turbine blades. Okay. Now you put this in a desert where the air is very, very hot and very, very dry. And at the very top of the tower is a water injection system, and they pump water up the tower. The water gets sprayed in a fine mist. That fine mist ends up saturating that dry, hot air, which makes it heavier and makes it start to rush down the center of the tower. And so it's kind of like a reverse chimney in a way. That air rushes down and it hits the ground and goes out through the turbines, turning the turbine blades.
So rather than harvesting wind, you're creating your own.
Yeah, you're making wind.
Sounds kind of like...
That's a terrible way of putting it.
Kind of similar to geothermal somehow, you're pouring water down there to create the steam from the heat.
Yeah, in this case, you're just using a very fine mist to create heavy air, and then you channel that heavy air down through the turbine blades. It's an interesting idea. Supposedly, the wind speeds hit a pretty gusty level when it gets to the bottom, somewhere around 50 miles per hour. So that's a decent breeze. There are some disadvantages. These things are tall. They're big. They're like 200 feet tall. It's still, a large thing that you have to build, and you're limited to where you can build them. You can't just put these suckers like in here in the Southeast. We've got really high humidity. So injecting the air with water would not necessarily create the effect we would need. We would have to have it in a very dry area.
Right, right. You put one of those suckers in Florida and people are like, there's no change.
Yeah, it's like a swamp cooler in Florida. It doesn't do any good.
Yeah, though, pretty much all wind power is subject to geographical limitations.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Wind power is very dependent on places where there's a lot of wind.
Yes, that's one of the odd things about it, yeah. And no, it really does make it challenging. I mean, your point is extremely valid. I mean, cause the electricity you generate, you're likely not going to be transporting that huge distances, right? It's not like the Mojave Desert is going to generate all the electricity for everybody on the eastern seaboard. That doesn't really make any sense. So, that's another limitation that we have to talk about. But that was one of those things that I thought was kind of interesting. This idea of this tower system, it's really more like a proof of concept right now. It's not like something that's been widely rolled out. You can go to their website and check out the information there. They have lots of little videos and things. The Solar Wind Energy Tower is what I'm talking about. So go check that out, and you can see exactly, you know, like little animations on how this is supposed to work. But another one is kind of the idea of if you go to those higher altitudes, you can harness those steady winds, but even 300 feet may not be high enough. And yet you don't want to build towers that are going way up into the sky. It makes it very dangerous, and not a lot of people would be very thrilled with that. So what if you could just fly something up at the right altitude and then channel the electricity you generate back down?
Yeah, these air drones.
Yeah.
That we talked about, or you talked about, I was there in the video episode.
Yeah, yeah. There's one called the Makani Power Drone, which is kind of interesting. All right, so imagine a wing, a flying wing, that's
like
designed
a stealth bomber kind of thing.
Yeah, it doesn't quite look like that. It looks almost like the early sketches look more like a biplane almost.
Oh, okay.
But it's supposed to be a flying wing that is at least partially designed to mimic the end of a blade on one of these turbines. So, it has these little propellers on the front that can act as both propellers and turbine blades. So if you spin them one way, they're propellers, and then if you let the wind blow them the other way, you turn off the power, you let the wind blow them, they can actually turn a direct generator and generate electricity.
Huh. This is all playing into the fact that all of these turbines, the airfoils are designed to create lift the same way that an airplane would.
Yeah.
In order to take off. And, you know, that's just creating an area of pressure differential between the top and the bottom, or I guess top and bottom doesn't really apply necessarily to vertical blades, but yes, you're creating a low pressure system that's going to end up
turning this. Yeah, creating that force of turning. Because otherwise, if you didn't angle it just right, then you wouldn't get that rotational force out of it. So the way this one works is, imagine that you got a little pedestal, and on that pedestal you have this drone thing that looks like a biplane with several little propellers in the front of it. The wind at the right elevation, which would be between 250 to 600 meters, that's about 800 to 1950 feet. Somewhere around that range. Let's say that the wind is perfect. So the pedestal would tilt back, putting the aircraft into launch position. So now the little propellers are facing essentially straight up. They start spinning. It creates the lift. The power is being channeled through a tether. So there's a tether on a ground station that's also attached to this little aircraft. Now, the aircraft doesn't have to have batteries. It doesn't have to have fuel because it's getting all of its electricity through that tether. That means that the aircraft itself is incredibly light. So it then will take off until it gets to the right altitude. The tether will become taut, and it will then tilt into the wind and fly in a kind of wacky little, almost like, well, a circular formation that more or less mimics the pathway that a turbine blade would go through. And it would do this harnessing the wind power. The wind would be blowing those little propellers that now are turbine blades. And they don't have to go through a main shaft gearbox kind of thing. They have a direct, they just have little tiny magnets there. They have a direct generator right there on the aircraft itself, which reduces the complexity and size of the aircraft. And then all the electricity goes back down through the tether to the ground station, which is pretty cool. Now, so that means you can actually harness the air that's at a higher altitude without building a huge tower.
Mm-hmm.
It takes up less space. It takes up less materials to build it. According to the website, the typical aircraft would cost 50% of a traditional turbine, so you have cost savings from that on that side of things. And it's such an interesting idea that a very large company took interest in it and decided to help them out, but to the tune of acquiring the company. So,
yeah, that would be Google.
That is true. Google, in May of 2013, purchased Makani Power, and now it is part of Google X, which is their division where they really look into environmentally friendly ways of generating electricity. Both because, you know, Google kind of has this mission to really help just the environment in general, but also how can they provide electricity to their massive data centers in a way that's, you know, environmentally responsible and also economically feasible, you know?
And they just generally seem to be into making the future happen.
Yeah. They're kind of, and they're definitely not afraid of trying things, even if those things never really pan out.
They can afford it.
Yeah.
They can.
So
yeah.
There are people who are skeptical that this approach and the other air-based ones that I'm about to talk about are going to work out, but it's possible. Another one, actually, I'll go ahead and pair two of these together. There's one called Ampix and one called Windlift. Both of these use a very similar method to generate electricity. So these are two gliding type aircraft. One of them is more like a kite, that's Windlift, and the other one looks more like looks kind of similar to the Makani Power one. But in each case, these are designed to fly up into the air, to glide it at these altitudes. And the way they generate electricity is not by turning little turbines. The tether itself ends up allowing them to have a ground-based generator, and pulling the tether ends up creating the kinetic energy you need to generate the electricity on the ground. So instead of generating the electricity in the air and sending it down, it's like, you know, kind of like if you have, this is a totally different model here, but let's say you need to start your motor on your lawnmower.
Yeah, you're getting the sky to start your lawnmower.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, except instead of a motor, we're talking about a generator. But yes, similar idea, and both of them are designed to do that. So the way it works is that you let the wind pull the aircraft out to the maximum length of the tether, and then you then start to have the aircraft dive down, and then you gently take in the slack of the tether, which will actually consume some of the electricity that you've generated, but hopefully a much smaller amount than the overall amount you've generated. And you let it go back out again, generating more electricity, and you do that over and over and over again.
What I'm thinking is that really we can capitalize on children's ability to play with kites if we just send an army of children out with
attached to generators.
Yeah,
children are bored with kites.
I'm just saying, look,
they just play with their iPhones.
Here's how I say, forget the kites. If this power is generated by pulling a cord attached to a generator, just attach the cord directly to the kids and have them run around. There, you got it. That's
there you
it.
Go.
You take the kites out of it.
Energy problem solved, you guys. Good work. Yeah. Good
right,
work today.
Right. We solved two problems. Kids and our electricity crisis. So moving on, there are two more air-based ones I want to talk about. They're very similar in that these are two lighter-than-air solutions. So there's one that's the Majin Power, which is a helium-based one where they have a gadget called Mars, which is their inflatable helium balloon generator thing. Think of it like a giant inflatable turbine. So it's kind of tricky to think about. All right, so think of like a big balloon. All right, it's roundish, and you've got on either side of the balloon, along its horizontal axis, you've got the little generators that are hooked up to a tether that go down to the ground. And if you were to look along the edge of the balloon, like if you were to cut the balloon in half vertically, instead of cutting it in half, along that slice, you've got little ridges where the wind can catch.
Okay.
So if the wind catches the balloon there, it makes the balloon turn along that horizontal axis. Mm. So the entire balloon is like a giant inflatable turbine. You put that up into the right altitude. You let the wind turn this balloon in the air. That in turn allows the generators to generate electricity. You send that back down to the ground. The other one is the Alteros, which is a donut-shaped balloon.
Toroid.
Yeah.
It's a toroid. It's my favorite silly word that just means donut.
Right. Exactly. It is, so you can imagine the sort of donut shape, this balloon shell in the center where the hole is. That's where you have a turbine mounted there. It's got, some mounting, rods that hold it in place from the center of this donut hole. And that you can float up to the right altitude, and then wind will blow the turbine blades just as it would if it were supported on a stand, as opposed to being suspended in the middle of this giant helium balloon. And all of these are interesting ideas. They've all been shown off in various prototype stages. We don't have any real, like, wide rollout of any of these yet, but they all seem at least feasible. I don't know how plausible it is to have them as generating meaningful amounts of power, but it's interesting to see the innovation, and I hope that it leads to practical application.
Oh, certainly, yeah. No, based on, I mean, because some of the problems that people have with wind turbines are the fact that they are potentially changing the environment that they're in.
Sure. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the pros and cons of wind turbines and wind power. All right. So, I mean, okay, smaller greenhouse gas emission, you know, smaller carbon footprint, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's actually, okay, well, so here's one thing that people have started to realize is helpful. Because obviously when a wind turbine is turning, it's not burning any carbon-based thing. It's not releasing any greenhouse gases doing that.
Right. Some vertical axis wind turbines do need a little bit of startup juice.
Okay.
But for the most part, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not
once
like
it gets going,
running a car engine, you know.
Right.
Right.
Just a spilling. But the production, the implementation, all power sources do have some kind of greenhouse gas emission. And so one thing that's important to look at is the life cycle analysis of a kilowatt hour produced by any given type of energy.
Sure.
So how does wind power stack up from, you know, this cradle to grave analysis? Well, according to a report I found, that was, reprinted by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory.
Thank you. Laboratory.
Laboratory.
Appreciate that.
That's funded by the Department of Energy. And they offered an overall LCA report that found wind, both offshore and land-based together, produced about 11 grams of CO2 equivalent per kilowatt hour of electricity. Mm-hmm. That's compared to about 1,000 grams for coal.
Wow.
So significantly fewer.
So that's, yeah, a bunch.
That's, what,
more than
1%?
Yeah, more than 2, yeah. Or not more than 2%, more than...
Less than 2.
Yes.
So it's, compared to fossil fuel burning, the overall life cycle analysis says wind is a whole lot better
in
terms of greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
It's generally considered pretty comparable to other renewables like solar or hydroelectric.
Right. So, and that's another key is that we're talking about a renewable energy source. It's not it's not like something that we could feasibly run out of. Although, as we were saying before we started this podcast, there is always the chance that climate change over time could shift where the windiest spots are. So if you're talking about some of the more permanent wind farms that could potentially maybe, and it may not be for a really long time, but it could potentially change how effective they are, just whether or not they get as much wind as they did when you first built them.
Sure.
Yeah, that's true. Wind is not going away, but it might be going somewhere, meaning that weather patterns changing, especially due to something like climate change, could, say, move a jet stream from one place to another.
Right.
There's also some evidence that wind farms themselves could be causing local weather changes.
Say what?
No, there was a study published in Nature Climate Change in 2012, and this was taking satellite data from NASA's Aqua and Terra satellites, and it found that the land surface temperature around 4 Texas wind farms had warmed at a rate of 0.72 degrees Celsius, which is about 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit, over the course of about 10 years of data.
That's a significant warming.
Which is a bunch, yeah. If you guys listen to our climate change episode, I mean, that's
significant.
That's a bunch. And they think that what's going on here is that the turbines are mixing that hot and cool air, especially at night. They're pulling warm air that's risen during the day back down to the ground and causing this warming, and that, you know, they don't know what's going to happen with that. And so no one really knows what effect this could possibly have. I mean, you know, not only on whether or not the wind pattern is going to change, but obviously on the environment around these wind farms.
And there are other environmental concerns as well. For example, I've often heard concerns about wind farms and the health of the local wildlife, specifically bats and birds.
Birds and bats, yeah. Did you look into this one, Joe? You're giving me a blank look of fear. Yeah, well, I don't know about birds, but I think, but with bats, one of the theories is that, okay, so they've got all these dead bats around wind farms, and it's not that they're getting caught up in the turbines or something like mm-hmm. that. There's a theory that the low pressure areas created by the mixing agency of that wind, bat lungs are very sensitive, and so when they enter very suddenly a pocket of low pressure air, they could be swelling and expanding so much that they burst blood vessels and kind of spontaneously just drop.
Golly. Well, beyond that, I know that a lot of wind farms tend to generate sounds that are well outside the frequency of human hearing, but I imagine that for some animals might be somewhat distressing as well.
Infrasound, yes.
Yeah.
And this is a big part of what is referred to as wind turbine syndrome,
yep.
Which is not... Okay, it has never been proved or disproved in a laboratory anywhere. It was named by a pediatrician, Dr. Nina Pierpoint, whose husband happens to be an anti-wind activist.
Huh.
Yeah.
And whose study involved a small sample of phone interviews with no controls or peer reviewing involved.
Right.
But lots of people have reported, kind of colloquially, from living around wind farms, all kinds of symptoms from headaches to sleep problems, night terrors and learning disabilities in children, ringing in the ears, mood problems, concentration memory problems, and issues with dizziness and nausea.
Right.
So,
and I would say, I mean, my first inclination here is to say that people are identifying symptoms and then are going in search of a problem, that's my inclination. I'm not saying that that's what's happening, but that's kind of the feeling I get simply because we've seen this sort of thing happen in other, areas before, things like living near power lines or being really sensitive to Wi-Fi, that whenever we put this up to any kind of double blind test, the supposed effects seem to disappear. Now, this has not been put to that. And because of the infrasound, there is at least a maybe not plausible, but a possible explanation that it could very well be contributing to some effects that we don't fully understand. So it's, you know, one of those things where we definitely need someone to take a look at it from a very scientific point of view,
right,
and find out if there really is an actual effect here, because that could be the case. I'm skeptical, but it doesn't mean that it's impossible.
Certainly there have been laboratory studies that have confirmed that infrasound has an effect on human people. I mean, but biologically speaking, there aren't a lot of things recorded. When you get intense enough infrasound for long enough, you can have stuff like hearing loss. We know that from people working in factories, for example. But in these our modern times, we're surrounded by infrasound. It's not like it's nowhere. And basically the primary effect is annoyance, which clinically speaking is a mix of sensitivity to a noise and anxiety about your sensitivity to the noise.
Right.
Which kind of conflates into something that can cause things like chronic sleep loss, which has a lot of the symptoms that are reported in wind turbine syndrome. So, I mean, so you're talking about minor body vibration, you know, increased sensitivity to and a lack of coping with a continual noise, which can lead to other psychological stuff like lower work performance and increased stress.
Right. And then you have the addition of any other symptoms you might be suffering from completely unrelated sources,
which you attribute then to, or which goes into that anxiety.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Then you have the escalation of anxiety problems. And so it just becomes a big issue. And we honestly, we don't know, again, like I said, what, if any, extent the wind farms contribute to this sort of stuff. There are people who have gone so far as to say, yes, this is what is causing all these issues, but we don't have any actual scientific evidence of that. And like I said, I'm pretty skeptical that they're as rough as they've been made out to be.
seems like the kind of thing that it would be fairly easy to design a very good scientific test for.
Oh, sure. It'd be very easy.
And record, I mean, you can certainly record the vibration of wind farms. And there are technologies that are being researched and implemented into dampening the vibration of sound and equipment around wind farms. You know, from pads that dampen the structure vibration to like counter vibrations to cancel out things that are being created by the turbines.
Gotcha. So yeah, that's kind of interesting. So there are some other issues with wind turbines, obviously. One of them is the whole concept of intermittency, which is the same issue that you have with a lot of other renewable sources like solar energy, which is that it's not always windy, just like it's not always sunny, except in Philadelphia. So you've got this issue where if the wind's not always blowing, then you're never going to be producing electricity at full capacity. So remember earlier I said that wind turbines typically, if you hear like, oh, well, it generates 300 kilowatts, that's based on it operating at full capacity for as long as its operating life is, which tends to be a couple decades, 20 to 30 years in general. So that's great if it were operating at full capacity all the time, but it's not. In fact, most of them are operating at around 20% capacity. If you are able to build them offshore where winds are more consistent, you might be able to get that up to about 40%. But that's still...
I mean, compared to solar panels, you're doing pretty good there.
And even then you're talking about it's 40% of the time it's operational. It's not even... Not saying it's 40% efficiency in the sense of... it's converting 40% of the wind into energy, which is what we're talking about with solar energy. It's like, you know, out of the 100% of solar energy that's hitting a solar panel,
we're able to capture
20%. On a really good day, you're talking about 20%.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're talking about
a really good technology, you're talking about 20%.
Yeah. In the lab, you might be able to boost that just below 50%, but that's in the lab, which, you know, as we all know, most of the solar panels, not in the lab. intermittency is a problem and efficiency is a problem. And the amount of power they can provide, that all depends again on the design of the solar panel, the wind turbine. And, like some of them could generate enough power to supply 600 homes on a single wind turbine, which is pretty interesting. If you got a wind farm of significant size, you could definitely support a small to medium sized community, which is not a bad thing at all. I mean, but it's still, you know, it's small potatoes when you compare it to the overall population of a country as large as, say, the United States. Clearly, wind energy, at least in the implementations that we have right now, and I would argue even in the case that we are able to create these new and improved type of wind farms, I don't think we're going to say that wind energy is going to become the patch that's going to replace carbon-based power systems right now, but it can certainly offset them.
Oh, sure, yeah. As of, I think, through the end of 2011, about 3% of all U.S. power was coming from wind farms. So, you know, room to improve.
Yes, certainly.
That's more than I would have guessed.
There are a lot of surveys that talk or reports that talk about the amazing growth of the wind power industry. But you have to remember that when you have so few, comparatively speaking, even doubling in size doesn't mean that it's a lot.
But it's a bunch,
right?
Right.
Like if I had three wind farms and now I've got six wind farms, I experienced 100% growth, but but it doesn't, you know, that doesn't translate into an overwhelming amount of electricity in the long run. There are a lot of people who have brought up the economic problems of wind farms. Specifically, they are pretty expensive to build, and they can be expensive to continue to have them working in proper order. I mean, depending upon who it was that made the parts, it may be very difficult to keep them in working order. And if the company that made those parts goes out of business, then you have to figure out how to repair things that break down over time. And I think there are a lot of parts of the world that are kind of burnt out on wind power. Because in those early days in the 1980s, when these wind farms were popping up all over the place, because a lot of governments were giving major subsidies.
Oh, we were also having a big oil crisis around the world then. So.
Exactly. We had an oil crisis, so there was a huge incentive to get off of oil as much as possible. And then we had government subsidies that were very, very much attractive to investors who thought they could make huge amounts of money back by investing in wind farms. The overall result was that not all the wind farms that went up were particularly well built. Not all of them were able to be maintained because once the subsidies started to drift away, there was kind of like a bubble burst, right? It's kind of like seeing, you know, this, if the government support starts to go away, then the major source of actual money going into that whole venture has gone away. It makes the thing kind of dissipate, which is sad because obviously we do have a need for clean, renewable energy. There's no denying that. It's just that if you can't make the money work because of the way the world works, that really means that it's kind of a, you know, it's sort of a dream. I like to think that with companies like Google behind wind power, we'll see some innovations that, you know, it might take a generation or two for them to be implemented in a way that's a pretty
widespread
form. Yeah. But I'm optimistic that will happen. I don't think it's going to happen as quickly as most people would like. I think it's going to be much more gradual than that. That is no reason to give up. There's no reason to say, oh, if it's not going to happen tomorrow, then I don't want to work on this.
You right. Know? Yeah. That's, no, I've
totally.
Got... I really like some of these ideas that you brought in to tell us about today.
Yeah, there's some pretty cool ones. I love the idea of the balloon based ones. I really want to see, I specifically want to see the Mars one in action, that giant balloon that's just turning in the sky. I kind of want to see what that looks like. So, if anyone wants to send me out and take a look at this in person, I'll take that ticket. I'll go see it. I don't mind.
How can they get in touch with us in order to send you such
a
ticket?
Hey, you know what? We've got a website. And it is awesome. Joe, you do a great job working on that website.
Why, thank you, sir.
You are welcome. That website, by the way, is fwthinking.com. And if you would like to see the hard work that Joe puts in, go to fwthinking.com. That's where we have the videos, the blog posts, the podcast. We have links to articles. There's a lot of really cool stuff in there. You can also follow us on social media. We are on Twitter. We're on Facebook. Look for FW Thinking at both of those locations. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing.
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel, it's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it. Tanner girl, go shopping.
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.